Welcome back, friends. Welcome back to the Corbett Report. I'm your host, James Corbett of CorbettReport.com, coming to you, as always, from the sunny climes of Western Japan here in September of 2024 with another edition of Questions for Corbett, that regular series in which you send in the questions and I supply some answers. And this week we're going to turn to the mailbag for a question from Gracos? I don't know how to pronounce that. And Gracos writes, in recent interviews, for example, interview 1875, you stated that in your opinion, the underlying assumption of TPTB, the powers that be, the powers that shouldn't be, is the need of a top-down power structure. While your work is a very persuasive argument that is what they believe for the normal people, my question is, do you think they believe in that for themselves? In that inside the elite, there's also that top-down structure and its pyramids all the way to the top. Or do you think they would rather live in freedom? Is it a case of anarchy for me, but not for thee? All right, thank you very much for that creatively worded question, Gracos. I appreciate that. Pyramids all the way up? Turtles all the way down? No, it's pyramids all the way up. Well, that is a good question, because it gets at an interesting and important point, namely, where does top-down power end? Or phrased from the opposite direction, where does anarchy begin? Or where does anarchy end might actually be the best way of formulating that question. So, as you will remember from episode 261 of the Corbett Report podcast from back in 2013, easy for me to say, which was recently republished as a flashback episode on international law, you'll recall that the core concept of international law is near and dear to the heart of the globalists, precisely because it promises to bring an end to the anarchy that exists, that already exists between nations, and to bring the world under one centralized governing body, a world order for a world government, a new world order for a new world government, if you will, and headed by some sort of world court that can dare to pronounce on all of these things. And this is precisely the point that President George H.W. Bush was making back in his infamous New World Order speech on September 11th, 1990.
And we stand today at a unique and extraordinary moment. The crisis in the Persian Gulf, as grave as it is, also offers a rare opportunity to move toward an historic period of cooperation. Out of these troubled times, our fifth objective, a new world order, can emerge, a new era, freer from the threat of terror, stronger in the pursuit of justice, and more secure in the quest for peace. An era in which the nations of the world, east and west, north and south, can prosper and live in harmony. 100 generations have searched for this elusive path to peace, while 1,000 wars raged across the span of human endeavor. And today, that new world is struggling to be born, a world quite different from the one we've known, a world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle, a world in which nations recognize the shared responsibility for freedom and justice. A world where the strong respect the rights of the weak. This is the vision that I shared with President Gorbachev in Helsinki. He and other leaders from Europe, the Gulf, and around the world understand that how we manage this crisis today could shape the future for generations to come.
Today, that new world is struggling to be born. A world quite different from the one we've known. A world where the rule of law supplants the rule of the jungle. Oh, words to make the heart of any good indoctrinated statist authoritarian just quiver. Oh, doesn't it sound so beautiful? But what does it really mean? What is he really getting at with these words? Why is this the crux of the New World Order? It's because the real bugbear of the would-be authoritarians, the would-be rulers of the world, the thing that really sticks in their craw is the idea that there is not some central controlling authority, a world court or a world government or world assembly or other body that can enforce laws in the same way that a Supreme Court can enforce laws within a country. That is the problem, according to George H.W. Bush and his fellow travelers, and that is what they are attempting to solve in bringing in the New World Order. So, if you really want to get into the problem of anarchy, the anarchy that exists between nations and is the natural state of international relations as it has existed in the nation-state era, at any rate, and how that problem has been formulated by various international relations thinkers over the course of the past century, you could turn to an exploration like The Discourse of Anarchy in IR in the journal International Theory from the year 2015 by Jack Donnelly, and you can follow the cookie crumb trail of all the references and footnotes in that work back to the various authors who have written about this problem. But I'll go one better. I'll give you one that I don't believe, off the top of my head, I don't believe Donnelly cites, but he should. Probably the most interesting flipping of that question. Oh, the problem of anarchy between nations, and how can we solve this? What kind of world court or what have you can we bring in to solve this? Well, the exact opposite take is provided in a really wonderful article called Do We Ever Really Get Out of Anarchy? By Alfred G. Cousin from the Journal of Libertarian Studies from 1979. And I'll just read you just a little bit of that, just to give you a taste of it. He writes, "Anarchy is a social order without government, subject only to the economic laws of the market. Government is an agent external to society, a third party, with the power to coerce all the other parties to relations in society into accepting its conceptions of those relations. The idea of government as an agent external to society is analogous to the idea of God as an intervener in human affairs. For an atheist, a good analogy might be to assume that omnipotent Martians fill the role we usually ascribe to government, i.e. an external designer and enforcer of rules by which everyone subject to those rules must abide. However, that the idea of government exists is no proof of its empirical existence. Few of us would be convinced by an argument such as, I believe the idea of God is possible, therefore God exists. Yet, such is the structure of the argument which underlies all assumptions about the existence of government. That societies may have some form of organization they call the government is no reason to conclude that those governments are empirical manifestations of the idea of government. A closer look at these earthly governments reveals that they simply do not get us out of anarchy at all. They simply replace one form of anarchy by another, and hence do not give us real government. Let's see how this is so." And that's precisely what Cousin proceeds to do in the rest of that article. It is a brilliant read. It is only 7 pages long. You have absolutely zero excuse from not following the link in the show notes to this edition of Questions for Corbett back to that article, which I'll provide in PDF format so you can read it. It won't take that long, even if you're a slow reader. Brilliant piece, highly recommended. And it gets, I think, to the more interesting part of this problem of anarchy. But long story short, the quest to end anarchy altogether and to establish this top-down pyramid that stretches all the way up to the very top of a single central world-controlling body is the essence of globalism, and it's why the term globalist and globalism is not some waffly euphemism that we use to describe the cabal of would-be world controllers when we don't want to say a real name or something. No, it is the central characteristic that defines all of these diverse groups that are part of that pyramidal power structure, and it describes their end goal and thus their agenda to create a global system of centralized, top-down, authoritarian control. But what about the elitists themselves? Do they organize themselves in such a manner? Do they recognize a top-down command and control structure and hew to a chain of command like a military, taking orders from whoever is at the very top? Well, I think the first point to be made here is let's not fall into the comic book cartoon version of conspiracy theorizing that I have decried in the past. Excuse me, the idea that there is one script that all of the world misleaders and all of the financial chieftains and all of the captains of industry and all of the black nobility and everyone else in the upper echelons of this power structure dutifully follow. Okay, everybody, turn to page 273 of the world script. And okay, so now Putin, you're going to say, you're going to invade Ukraine and say it's about denazification. And Xi, you're going to be over here doing it. And Trump, you've got to talk about immigrants eating dogs. And now, okay, now over here, you're going to... That's nonsense. That's childish nonsense. And I think it is a straw man that's either been constructed deliberately and it's deliberately seeded into the discourse in order to create that straw man, or I suppose there are people of low enough IQ to actually believe that there exists such a script or that things are handed down in such a manner. But whatever the case may be, it certainly lets the fact-checkers score an easy victory in knocking down that straw man argument. No, my take is that there is a core tenet of the conspirators, that there should be. Yes, we do need that kind of top-down hierarchy, and I'm sure they would love a system in which they can write some multi-thousand-page script and just hand it to every single political leader and everyone else on the planet, and they'll all just say exactly what needs to be said and do exactly what needs to be done at the exact right time. They would love that, yes, of course. But that's precisely why they fight so fiercely amongst each other for the privileged position of being the ones in that ultimate seat of power to be able to write such a script and to control world events. But it is, make no mistake, an ongoing power struggle that continues to go on. And just because you and I are not participating in that power struggle does not mean that it is not happening. It just means that it's difficult for us at our level to really understand or conceptualize what that struggle looks like or how it takes place. So if you want nuts and bolts, brass tacks, documented facts about that struggle, you would be hard-pressed to find a better place to find out more about that than The Road to 9/11 by Peter Dale Scott, an absolutely fantastic researcher who I think is unfortunately too often neglected these days in the conspiracy realist spaces, alternative media generally. The godfather, the grandfather of deep politics and the deep state analysis in the English language, at any rate, from the late 20th century. And this is such an important book, if only, and not only, but if only, because of chapter 4 of this book on Brzezinski, oil, and Afghanistan, where Peter Dale Scott brilliantly lays out the struggle between competing factions of the deep state for control of the Carter administration's foreign policy in the late 1970s. And its ultimate, the positioning of the U.S. into the fight against the Soviets in Afghanistan, the proxy war in Afghanistan and other places. In a time in which Carter came in promising and certain elements of his administration were talking about some sort of detente with the Soviet Union. And there was moves towards SALT II and disarmament talks and what have you. But that somehow all got undermined and everything collapsed, and suddenly the U.S. was in this proxy war with Afghanistan and everything kind of fell to pieces, and Ronald Reagan picked them up, i.e. George H.W. Bush. Remember all that? Well, how did that happen exactly? Peter Dale Scott lays it out piece by piece, talking about the specific things that were done, the Team B reviews that were providing contradictory recommendations to the president, and the National Security Council strong-arming and undermining the president with regards to the State Department's policy recommendations. Brzezinski's influence in the formation and propagation of Presidential Directive 18 from Carter, which helped undermine Vance's, Secretary of State Vance's, SALT II disarmament talks, etc. Again, there's a lot of detail in here that's really important, and it's one of the best encapsulations. And just it's only, again, this chapter is only several pages long, but it goes into that detail that I don't see often of the how two factions of a deep state competition take place for control of this or that arm of to steer the military-industrial complex in this way or that way. We could point to other examples of that. I mean, for example, I have pointed in the past to Brzezinski's, I believe it was 2007 testimony to a Senate committee. Anyway, I'll put the link in so you can find that for yourself, but in which he was warning at that time against the neocons, who are, of course, the other side of that deep state faction war. Brzezinski was on the Democrat side, whatever you want to call it, of that war, and he was warning against those neocons, and they might try to pull some sort of false flag provocation to start a war with Iran. Remember when Brzezinski was warning about that? Why? Why do these types of things go on? And there are many, many more examples we can point to, and it's precisely because there are competing factions that have different ideas for how to reach that same end goal that I think adequately describes all of the various factions in the power struggle. They all want to create this gigantic, centralized, controlling, authoritarian, top-down pyramidal structure that stretches all the way to the top and which eradicates anarchy between nations and everything else, is a complete and total centralized control of the world. That is what they're aiming for, but they have different, there are different teams, different groups, different strategies, different players at that table, and they do compete with each other. And this is where things become difficult for us at our level to understand, to really conceptualize that, because out of all of the Hollywood Fantasyland programming that we've been indoctrinated with since the moment we were born, we've been taught to believe that in any sort of big power struggle, big fight, it's always some big heroic battle between the forces of good and the forces of evil. So you've got to take a look at the two forces that are fighting against each other and say, oh, these guys are the forces of good and these guys are the forces of evil. And then you pick a side and you root for your side. But picking sides in this great struggle for who is going to rule over the global government centralized body of control is merely rooting for global government. That is what you're doing in the end, and that is not, obviously, the real answer to how to defeat globalism. So how do you really defeat globalism? Well, actually, I have something very specifically on that point that will be coming in the near future that I will draw your attention to at the appropriate time, but anyway, you can imagine that at the very least, choosing your side on the big power struggle amongst the elite, the elitists, not the elite, the elitists, for their particular team to win and take over and write that script for the entire world, that is no solution at all. So, in the meantime, the entire point of the global conspiracy is to cement into place that pyramidal power structure that will extend all the way to the top. And it has not been cemented into place yet, which is why we see, for example, the Bilderberg CIA Thiel, Federal Reserve, Global Bankster Diamond, DOD Cutout, Musk, Zionist Adelson faction using their Trump Vance puppets to war against the Global Bankster Soros, Bilderberg Eric Schmidt, Biosecurity State, Gates faction, Harris Waltz puppets. And unfortunately, we've been dumbed down as society enough to look at that stupid puppet marionette stage play taking place and to truly believe, oh, this is an election, and wow, I get to cast a vote, and it'll really change things, guys. Total nonsense. And now you understand why. It is because this represents nothing other than a power faction struggle within the globalist, elitist forces. And either way you pull that lever, it's going in the same direction. The wrong direction. Anyway, so I am very glad, thank you, Grakos, for bringing this question up, because I think it is an important one for us to understand. We, to some extent, the entire point of the Corbett Report is to understand and to better articulate the way that power operates in society. And when we have a silly, childish conception of how power operates in society, whether either we're drinking the MSM normie Kool-Aid and totally believe everything is exactly surface level, exactly as it's presented in the mainstream media narratives and all of that, or if you fall down the conspiracy rabbit hole and start believing that there's this top-down script and it's written by one person who controls everything and every single person in the world is following this script and they know exactly what to say and do next because they're following the script. Both are equally stupid, cartoonish, and childish. Let's deepen our conception of what is happening so that we can better understand how to situate ourselves and how to actually move in the opposite direction of a top-down, centralized global authority. Anyway, I put those thoughts out there for you to ponder at your leisure. Do with them what you will. But thank you for the question. Looking forward to answering more questions in the near future, but that's going to do it for today. I am James Corbett of CorbettReport.com. Thank you for your time and attention.